Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Good morning. Welcome to Radio Activity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, coming up, Donald Trump's connections to Russian businessmen and oligarchs goes back more than 30 years. We'll hear about the history of Trump and Russian moneyed interests in a few minutes. This year also marks the 20th anniversary of the signing of the peace accord in Northern Ireland. And there's going to be an event tonight in Tampa to mark that milestone. Later, we'll open up the phone lines to talk about these and more topics. First, two listener comments about the portion of yesterday's program where we discussed the consumer boycott of the Publix supermarket chain. Here's two very different views on that topic.
I was glad that you talked about boycotting Publix because they have a very long history of supporting right-wing causes, opposing progressive causes, and supporting right-wing politicians. They're supporting Adam Putnam, who has described himself as, quote, a total sellout to the NRA. They also have opposed medical marijuana, gay and lesbian rights, environmental protections, and farm worker protections. I have contacted Publix at their customer service number, 800-242-1227, and I asked to be transferred to whoever was taking comments about Publix's political donations. And I told that person that I will no longer be shopping at Publix at all ever again. And the good thing is that where I live in Pinellas, there's a wonderful health food store called Nature's Food Patch. There's plenty of alternatives to Publix, and I do not want one penny of my money to go to them so they can take that money and support things that are bad for Florida.
My name's Ernie. I'm from Port Richey. This call is about the debate about Publix. The issue appears to be the disagreements with their political stance and the people that they gave contributions to. One thing that I'm noticing of late about some members of the left is if you disagree with them, they immediately find you illegitimate. Just because someone disagrees with you doesn't make you illegitimate. Looking at Publix, perhaps you all should consider the fact that they're in the Fortune 100 top best employers to work for. And one of the things that I hear a lot is on this station is worrying about the workers. Well, I've been a worker myself most of my productive life. Here's some breakdown in Publix. 42% minorities, of which 21% are African American and black, 3% Asian, 58% Caucasian or white, 16% Latino or Hispanic. That's a pretty fair spread in their employees. Also, they're all age ranges, everywhere from very young people all the way to, I think their oldest employee is 90 years old. And so I think it's important to look at the overall business rather than just one particular aspect and decide that they're illegitimate.
Well, there you have two listener comments about the Publix boycott controversy that came in after yesterday's program. This year marks the 20th anniversary of the Belfast Agreement, more commonly known as the Good Friday Agreement, which was signed in Northern Ireland in April of 1998. It effectively brought an end to the troubles which had raged in the region for 30 years and established a cross-community consensus for peace and the future direction of the region. From the late 1960s, Northern Ireland was plunged into a brutal conflict between Republicans who wanted the province to become part of a united Ireland and Unionists who wanted to remain with the United Kingdom. Republicans and the wider nationalist community are mostly Catholic, while the Unionists were mostly Protestant. Tonight in Tampa, a film about the historic peace accord will be shown at 7 p.m. The film is called In the Name of Peace, John Hume in America. Hume is sometimes called the Martin Luther King of Northern Ireland. Here's the trailer to the film. The film is narrated by Liam Neeson and includes interviews with Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, and Tony Blair.
Born into a background of injustice and division, John Hume was a decisive leader of the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland in 1968.
First, he was real. And secondly, he didn't seem to have an agenda other than the one he was pursuing. He wanted an inclusive peace. And he thought that nonviolence was the best way to pursue it. He was the Irish conflict's Martin Luther King.
John Hume resolutely pursued a peaceful path throughout the Northern Irish conflict.
Before we even got there, you opened fire.
This is the story of how John Hume harnessed the political influence of the Irish-American diaspora to address that legacy of division and to achieve peace.
I think he understood language to be part of the problem, the ability to speak the language of the American politic better than them is a plus.
Tip took his lead of what John was saying. I would say in those days, Tip was taking far more from John than he was from the Irish government, quite frankly.
The State Department was not in favor of what I did, as you may know, but I didn't really consult with them too thoroughly.
There was some broken china there. There were, you know, I had a lot of trouble with the British for a brief period, but I trusted Hume's instincts.
But then you had the American influence, which was a very strange thing for British politics.
It wasn't just the risk of alienating the British. It was also the risk that I would stick my neck out and IRA violence would continue and I would look like I'd been played for a fool.
I am standing here and telling the government that I believe that we have a real process of lasting peace and a total cessation of violence. Hurry up and deal with it.
He grabbed me by the wrists and held my hands and said, look, you can do it. You're near it.
In 1998, the Good Friday Agreement was signed and roundly endorsed in referenda on both sides of the Irish border, and the Northern Irish Troubles ended. Hume's strategy had become a political reality.
That's the trailer to the film John Hume, In the Name of Peace, John Hume in America. It's going to be shown tonight at 7 o'clock at the Tampa Theater. We're joined now by Ireland's Consul General Shane Stevens, who will take part in a panel discussion after the film shows tonight at the Tampa Theater. Shane Stevens, welcome to WMNF. Nice to have you here.
Rob, it's great to be with you.
So you're going to be in town tonight in Tampa at a showing of the film about the peace process in Northern Ireland. The film is called In the Name of Peace, John Hume in America. Tell us about John Hume.
Well, John Hume was an inspirational figure. He, over about 30 years, doggedly pursued peace and eventually got his way and was the moral architect for what we call the Good Friday Agreement. And the Good Friday Agreement was confirmed by the people of Ireland and Northern Ireland almost exactly 20 years ago. So that's why we're having this event in Tampa today.
John, was he a Social Democrat?
Yes, John was the a leading figure in the SDLP party. And that party was a reform-minded nationalist party from Northern Ireland. And John Hume was inspired by many people, but in particular by Martin Luther King, a man from this part of the world. And like Martin Luther King, he was determined to pursue nonviolence in bringing forward political change.
This is at a time when there was violence on both sides, the Unionists and the Catholics. They were at odds. The IRA was known for setting off bombs and that sort of thing. It was a pretty violent period that preceded 1998.
That's true, but John Hume was quite consistent in his following up on those principles of nonviolence that he had learned so much about from Martin Luther King. He did that really quite consistently from the 1970s all the way through to the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, and we see him as a sort of hero, certainly as the moral architect for the Good Friday Agreement. And John Hume, I think we're going to hear some very interesting things about him this evening after our screening at 7 p.m. at Tampa Theater, because we're going to have John Hume himself is now unwell and can't speak for himself, but his son Aidan Hume will be there. And we're also going to have a representative from the other political party, the Ulster Unionist Party, that in a way was honored with the Nobel Peace Prize. at the same time as John Hume was. It was John Hume and David Trimble of the Ulster Unionist Party that got the Nobel Peace Prize.
Is it fair to say that John Hume saw that Catholics in Northern Ireland were treated to a degree, not exactly the same, to a degree, though, that African Americans were treated here in the U.S.?
Well, I think what we can say is that John Hume was directly inspired by the example of Martin Luther King and his forceful approach to driving forwards significant political change and doggedly pursuing civil rights in a way that was determinedly nonviolent, in a way that was often the more complicated path, the more challenging path, but it was the right path, and both men stuck to it. And interestingly, when John Hume received the Nobel Peace Prize, the last words in his Nobel Peace Prize speech were, "We shall overcome."
Mm-hmm. So I understand that these kind of sessions where the film is showed, and there's also a discussion featuring people representing the Unionist Party and representing the other side, that this kind of event has taken place around the country. Is that around the U.S.? Is that true?
Yes, we've selected some of the most important hubs for Irish America to have these events. That's because this film also makes clear that Irish Americans, as well as Martin Luther King, were essential in pressing for peace in Northern Ireland. They pressed, and then the U.S. Congress and U.S. administrations acted to directly support our peace process, and that was essential. And we want to encourage the U.S. to stay closely involved. U.S. diplomacy has been highly valuable in Ireland, and we want to support that ongoing commitment from the U.S.
Is the agreement holding, would you say?
The agreement is holding. Over the last 20 years, it's brought about huge benefits in terms of peace. It's many aspects and most aspects of the agreement have been implemented. There are elements that haven't been fully implemented, but we're working on those with our partners, the UK, and with the parties in Northern Ireland. The Irish government, which I represent, and the United Kingdom government are co-guarantors, as we call it, of the Good Friday Agreement. So we're partners in guiding the implementation of that agreement, which is also something that has to be done by the parties in Northern Ireland, so the political parties in Northern Ireland.
At some point, both sides had to compromise. They had to turn back on positions that they previously held. That's hard to do.
But that's what real negotiations are about. They're about being practical. They're about going for real benefits for your people, in this case the people of Northern Ireland, and pressing ahead pragmatically. And I think both, whereas John Hume was a visionary, as was David Trimble, they both were also deeply pragmatic. We're committed to getting real results for their people on the ground. And again, today, the Irish government is keen to by showing films like this, by having talks and engaging with people in the U.S., we're keen to sort of remember how important the Good Friday Agreement was, remember what it's achieved. We're very keen to renew the vows of the Good Friday Agreement. So, you know, in a way, the Good Friday Agreement is like a marriage. And we want to see that marriage fully realizing the vows that led it into being. And we also want to push forward with reconciliation. So, you know, in Northern Ireland, we often talk about there being two traditions, the Unionist tradition, which is often linked with the Protestant tradition, and the Nationalist tradition, which is often linked, but not necessarily, with the Catholic tradition. And we want to see reconciliation between those two communities. That's an essential thing from our point of view.
What role did the Irish diaspora here in the U.S. play in pressuring the sides to come together and in pressuring the Clinton administration to take a stand and try to achieve peace?
The Irish American communities all around the United States, from the time of President Carter through the time of President Reagan and on to the time of President Bill Clinton and today, have consistently played a very positive role in keeping the focus on Ireland and on peace in Northern Ireland. And so they played an enormously beneficial role in that. The exact way in which they engaged with Congress and with the administration to encourage that supportive role by the U.S. is spelled out in some detail in this film. So in a way, this film is a wonderful affirmation of the value of U.S. diplomacy.
I just want to ask you about the toll before the peace accord was reached in 1998. Could you just describe for us what the death toll, what the injury toll, what the level of distrust was in Northern Ireland?
It's over many, many years, in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, terrible violence afflicted Northern Ireland, and huge numbers of people were killed and injured, and it was a terrible thing. But what we're trying to focus on today is also on the great things that have been achieved since then in the last 20 years. I mean, we're clear about how important it is that we turned away from those dark days, but we also want to be clear about the positive things that are coming out of Northern Ireland today. We also want to be clear that Northern Ireland, for example, has some of the best golf courses in the world. And sorry, that's a bit of a change of tune there, but Northern Ireland has some of the greatest golfers, it has great poets, it has great golf courses, it's a great place to visit on your holidays. I think the Northern Ireland economy is doing well now. And there are many things to be positive about, so that's also going to be part of what we're talking about today. And I'm going to be participating in today's events alongside the Deputy Director of the Northern Ireland Bureau from Washington. And also, I'll be working today alongside my colleague, David Prodger, the UK Consul General from Miami. So today is going to be a joint program by Ireland and the UK and the Northern Ireland Bureau, which is, of course, linked to the UK directly. And that's the kind of thing we're going to be doing today.
And just before we let you go, is there a single sign that you would point to in Northern Ireland today that shows that things have really turned the corner and that the peace agreement, the peace accord of 20 years ago has really taken hold? And here's a sign of how it works on the ground in Northern Ireland.
Well, the overall, the atmosphere has been transformed. Things are so far away from where they were. There's a peace dividend is being seen economically, and tourism is taking off. So the rounded picture is one of huge improvements.
Shane Stevens, is there anything else that you'd like to point out about today's Northern Ireland that perhaps I didn't ask you?
I'd just like to say that we do want to see fuller implementation of the Good Friday Agreement. We want to see fully functioning, devolved, power-sharing institutions operating again, because that's the only way forward for the politics of Northern Ireland. So that's something that the Irish government has on its mind.
And that'll be part of the discussion tonight at the Tampa Theatre at 7 o'clock.
Yeah, we're going to discuss all the issues from a full range of perspectives. We'll have the nationalist perspective represented, we'll have the unionist perspective represented, and we'll have the Northern Ireland Bureau, myself, and an esteemed academic, Catherine Shannon, there as well. So it's going to be a great discussion. Another thing we could mention as well is as part of our program of events, we also have a screening of a film from Northern Ireland called Zoo at 2 p.m.
And that's today at the Tampa Theatre.
Yeah, and that film will be presented by Richard Cushney, the Deputy Director of the Northern Ireland Bureau, Washington. I'm very proud of the fact that Bob Buckhorn, the Mayor of Tampa, will be hosting tonight's screening. And I will be joined at the screening by David Prodger, the UK Consul General, as well as Richard Cushney, the Deputy Director of the Northern Ireland Bureau in Washington, and then a host of really outstanding experts on Northern Ireland, including John Hume's own son, Aidan, Danny Kennedy, who is a former Northern Ireland minister, and Dr. Catherine Shannon, an expert academic and activist on the Northern Ireland political process.
Well, Shane Stevens, thank you so much for coming on WMNF.
Well, thank you so much for interviewing me. I appreciate it very much.
Well, Well, that was Shane Stevens, who is Ireland's consul general. He's based in Atlanta, and he'll be a part of the post-film discussion tonight at the Tampa Theater when the film In the Name of Peace, John Hume in America is shown at 7 o'clock. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. In a moment, we're going to investigate Donald Trump's ties to Russian oligarchs.
On long summer nights, in the wildest place, Radio Luxembourg, and AFM, and stars of jazz. And in the silence, we sank into restful sleep, carrying on dreaming in God. You're not dreaming. Well, on green, yeah. And in a righteous place.
Van Morrison, song about a street in Belfast called Hindford Street. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Well, while President Trump continues to deny that he's had much involvement with Russia, Robert Mueller's investigation appears to be picking up steam. Already 13 Russians have been indicted. How much do we really know about President Trump's ties to Russia? Well, in his new book, Trump, Russia, A Definitive History, former Associated Press journalist Seth Hetina sheds light on Trump's controversial personal and business ties. Trump, Russia is the first comprehensive history that examines Donald Trump's long-involved connections to Russia. Hetina traces Trump's relationships with corrupt Russian players back to 1984, chronicling the many years that Trump spent wooing Russian money and power and exposing his shady ties to the Russian mafia and revealing the truth about many Russians in Trump's orbit. I spoke with Seth Hetina yesterday, and here's that interview. Seth Hetina, welcome to WMNF.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, let me ask you, how do the Russians get so much money? What kind of Russian businesses allow people to get gobs of cash?
Well, Russia is one of the richest countries in natural resources. They have huge reserves. I think maybe the largest reserves of oil. It's not clear, but they're up there. And huge reserves of natural gas, aluminum. So they kind of generate enormous sums, and they always have, from sale of natural resources.
And why do they want to bring that money over here?
That's a great question. So, you know, in Russia, the deal is your money's never safe if it's in Russia. You know, your money is at the disposal of the Kremlin. If Putin or the Kremlin wants you to build a stadium or buy something, then you have to do it. So the only safe place for your money is out of Russia. So what they like to do is to invest in foreign properties. London's a big destination, and New York and Florida, and it's kind of like a safety deposit box. It's a way of kind of stashing your money overseas. No one can really take the apartment away from you, and it's just a kind of an insurance policy.
Now, is this ill-gotten money, or is this money that was legitimately acquired?
It's a mix. It's a mix. You know, not everybody in Russia is a criminal, but the state has become what experts see as basically a mafia state. It's like a quasi-criminal organization. And, you know, a lot of the big flows of money, the people at the top, you know, are basically in cahoots with the leadership and kind of do their bidding. And it's kind of this circle of conspiracy, basically. So, you know, there's a mix, but a lot of it, you know, a lot of it, especially the money that I've been tracking, is criminal.
Criminal by U.S. standards, criminal by Russian standards, whose standards?
Well, that's another great question. You know, I guess if you run the government, then you decide what's criminal. So, you know, if you're fine with taking large amounts of money out of natural resources and using it for their own gains, then that's, and you decide that's not criminal, then it's not criminal. But, you know, by U.S. standards,
It's difficult to prove. Again, Russia and the U.S. don't have an extradition treaty. So even if we were to charge these people, and the U.S. has charged many Russians, you know, they're safe in Russia. And if they're in close contact and close friendship with the Kremlin, then they're basically protected.
We're talking with Seth Hetna. His book is Trump Russia, A Definitive History, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. So if you're making this kind of money, we're talking about millions or maybe billions of dollars in Russia. If you're making this kind of money, do you have to have Kremlin approval? Does President Putin have to okay this and somehow allow you to get this money out of the country?
In general, yes. I mean, there may be some exceptions in there, but yes. If you're moving money around and you're dependent on the Kremlin for your patronage, you're not going to make big moves without consulting with someone up high first.
Just parenthetically, the Russian people got to be pissed at this if folks are looting their country, taking the money out and stashing it in the U.S. The folks in Russia have to really be angry about this.
I think so, and I think it's kind of an interesting picture. I think there is some anger at the Putin regime. You see periodic flare-ups of protests. But, you know, what happens is any legitimate opposition in Russia gets crushed, arrested, or even killed. And, you know, if I were as president and I killed all my opponents and put them in jail, I'd be pretty popular, too, because there's really no alternative. And Putin has gone, you know, he's basically become what some people see as a czar. He's ruled there for so long now that, you know, that he's just kind of got a stranglehold on power. And he kind of boosts his popularity by taking on the West. And it's an old game. He's kind of he reignited some of the Cold War mentality, and he's now kind of making people proud of Russia again by putting the U.S. down. That's kind of what his latest game is.
Let me ask you about your beat. You compiled this information as while you were a reporter for the Associated Press. Tell me, what was your beat, and then when did you first stumble on the fact that Donald Trump had connections to this Russian money?
Well, I have to correct you a little bit. I left the Associated Press. I've been freelance for a while. But what happened... The story was that after the election or during the election, I kind of started gathering little threads of information, just as an observer, really. And I remember during the convention hearing from a report about one Republican senator saying, the real story nobody's talking about here is Russia. And that kind of stuck in my head. And then after the election, you know, there was all this flurry of news about Russia. And I just started to try to, I couldn't understand it. I didn't understand what was going on. I didn't understand what these connections were about. And I just started to try to explain it to myself, really. And I started a website just compiling information, producing timelines. And then I started writing blog posts. I didn't know if anybody was interested. And then by the middle of the summer, it turned out, you know, I got a call and from an agent who told me, well, you know, you're getting pretty widely read. You know, and people are interested in this, and you know, you might want to consider making the, you know, taking it to a bigger audience, and that's kind of how it got started.
Mm. Is the website still up?
Yeah, it's trump-russia.com.
All right, we're talking with Seth Hetna. The book is Trump Russia: A Definitive History. So, how far back can you peg Donald Trump and the Russians having some sort of association?
So it starts in the 1980s. There was a group of Russian criminals in New York City that were running this super lucrative gas tax scam. They were cheating the New York State government out of money that should have been collected at gas stations. They owned, you know, a bunch of gas stations. And they were just pocketing this money instead of giving it to the government. And so every time somebody bought a gallon of gas at their station, they were making change. And it added up very quickly, and they had huge amounts of money. And they needed a place to launder it. And what I found was that Trump found them somehow and convinced them to invest in Trump Tower. So this group of Russian criminals bought five apartments, a block of apartments, all in the space of a few days, and for about less than $6 million. And that was the beginning of the association.
Was there anything unusual beyond the fact that where they got the money from, but was there anything unusual about buying a block of these properties?
Well, there was a couple of unusual things. One, Trump met these people at the closing, which is something he didn't usually do. And number two, you know, these were young Russian guys who barely spoke the language, you know, didn't really have any discernible source of income, and here they are, you know, buying, you know, spending huge amounts of money, and this is in the 80s, so, you know, $6 million was even more than it is now, on a block of apartments.
So I get, you know, they're not taking out mortgages.
No, they did not. Well, actually, you know, they did in weird ways. They did have kind of, they did leverage their mortgage. There were these kind of, I spent a bit of time looking into this, there were these kind of weird mortgages to people and to banks that had criminal associations, and they kind of leveraged their investment out and got cash out of the apartments. It was kind of one of their scams as well.
In your book, you say that Russian criminals laundered money at Trump's Atlantic City Taj Mahal casino. How did they do that?
Well, casinos are, like, notoriously vulnerable to money laundering, because if you have criminal money, you can go down to a casino, buy a bunch of chips, gamble a little bit, and then cash out and report it as winnings or you know, as proceeds. And so casinos develop these really sophisticated networks to thwart this, with the exception of Trump's casino. His casino systematically refused to implement money laundering controls, and it was kind of a huge loopholes down there. So Russian criminals were literally going down there, according to the federal investigators I talked to, with bags of cash, turning them into chips, maybe gambling. Maybe they kept the chips and cashed them out later, or you can even use them as currency in some cases. And so they were laundering money that way.
And was that illegal? That had to raise the interests of prosecutors. Was anybody prosecuted?
Well, the casino has been fined repeatedly by the Treasury Department for failing to implement these controls. And I think, you know, they've done multiple investigations over the years. And only a few years ago, they imposed, like, the biggest fine ever on a casino. And it's been actually the biggest fine ever in a couple of occasions. But the behavior didn't really change down there.
Now, okay, and are these Trump casinos that they imposed the biggest fine ever, or were these other casinos?
Yeah, it was the Taj Mahal. They had huge fines imposed on them by the Treasury Department.
One of the other revelations in your book are the ties between the Russian mafia, the NRA, and Trump. What did you find out?
So that's a really bizarre and kind of fascinating story. The NRA was infiltrated, basically, there's really no other way to put it, but by a group of Russians. There was a Russian senator and central banker named Alexander Torshin, and he's a legitimate gun enthusiast, and so he started making friendships in the NRA, and he got very high up in the organization. He befriended the presidents, multiple presidents of the NRA, and got invited to conventions and got special treatment at the conventions, and then there were back-and-forth invitations between Russia and the NRA and various gun rights groups there. And this pattern went on for a couple of years. And in the 2016 campaign, this Alexander Torshin, this senator, tried to open a backdoor to the Trump campaign. And he didn't succeed, but he got close. He got to a dinner where Don Jr. was attending. What I also found was that Torshin has been investigated by Spanish prosecutors who are trying to arrest him because he's a suspected mafia godfather. So he's a man who wears many hats, and he's clearly working on somebody's behalf to try to get into the Trump campaign. And that was just one of many attempts by Russia to get into the Trump campaign.
Did you find evidence that Russia gave the NRA lots of money?
Well, you know, that's something that I think the FBI and Robert Mueller are supposedly looking at. I didn't find any evidence of that. The NRA did give the biggest donation, I think, in its history to the Trump campaign. They usually don't give, I think it was on the order of about $20 million, but they don't usually give that much money. So that was unusual, but whether that's Russian or not, I can't say for sure.
Is there any evidence that the Russian oligarchs, these people with the gobs of cash, is there any evidence that they helped Donald Trump survive financial ruin?
There's circumstantial evidence, and, you know, there's just kind of bizarre patterns that you know, Trump, these kind of Russian criminal names keep showing up again and again in Trump projects and his buildings in Florida, in New York, and his casinos. And there's also huge flows of money that started coming into Trump's business in 2006. You know, before that, he was known as the king of debt. That's what he liked to call himself. But around 2006, he became the king of cash. And where that cash came from isn't clear, because banks weren't lending to him. He had gone bankrupt many times in the past, and he was considered a pretty high risk. So there's a lot of smoke there. I don't have proof, though, that the oligarchs were you know, had some kind of backroom deal where they sealed it with Trump.
We're talking with Seth Hetna about his new book, Trump, Russia, A Definitive History, and this is WMNF in Tampa. Tell me about this guy, Felix Sater, who shows up in your book and other people's books about Trump. Who is Felix Sater, and why is he important to look at?
Felix Sater, he's one of probably the most fascinating people in this whole story. He's a man who's managed to live multiple lives in the space of one. He was grew up in Brighton Beach, Brooklyn, which is kind of the headquarters for the Russian mafia in the United States. And his dad was a member of the mafia. He later got convicted of basically extorting businesses. So he grew up as a mobster's son. He tried to make it as a straight business, just working on the Wall Street stockbroker. And then he got into a nasty bar fight, and it was so bad that he went to prison for it. He lost his brokerage license, and he came out, and he got hooked up with a mob-linked Wall Street scam. And he was almost going to go to prison again for that, and this time he became a government informant. And this is one of the most fascinating parts of the story. He became a CIA undercover informant, working 10 years or more on the government sent him overseas for various investigations, and he, while he's working as a government informant, he hooks up with Trump and starts working in Trump Tower and develops a building in Manhattan called Trump Soho. And the money that came into Trump Soho was just very shady. There was a guy from Kazakhstan who was one of the developers. There was a Russian with shady connections who was also another big funder. And the whole thing is just one of Trump's most kind of strangest and suspect prospects. And so Felix Sater's at the center of that. And, you know, eventually his criminal connections were exposed by the New York Times. And Trump ever since has just kind of run away from him. Every time his name comes up, he kind of ducks and dodges and weaves. And he looks like a man with something to hide.
So at one point, Trump really embraced Sater, but now he says he barely remembers him.
Exactly, yeah. They were so close at one time that when Trump's children, Don Jr. and Ivanka, were going to Moscow, Trump asked Sater to kind of show them around. And that's there's this famous instance where Sater got Ivanka to sit in Putin's chair at the Kremlin on a tour. They kind of snuck in behind the rope and sat in the desk. And so, yes, if you're going to trust a man with your children, you're going to be pretty close to him. And now he kind of runs away from him. And I think it speaks more about Trump than it does about Sater. You know, that Trump always seems to choose people, or has often chosen people with really suspect backgrounds and questionable associations. He's done that over and over. And then he kind of runs away when the questions are asked.
When Sater's criminal past was exposed to the New York Times, Trump acted like he didn't know him. But there's a quote from Sater about making Trump president. Can you recall that quote?
Yeah, I can't remember the exact words, but there's this kind of bizarre email where he was talking about putting Ivanka in Putin's chair, and he says something along the lines like, we'll get our boy elected. He's writing to Michael Cohen, Trump's attorney, who's now in his own kind of legal mess. And, what's kind of emerged since then, there's been some good reporting that Sater has connections to some of Putin's cronies, some of his closest pals, who were actually his former judo sparring partners and get a lot of big construction contracts, some of these corrupt oligarchs we were talking about earlier. Somehow Sater has connections to these people. And he was talking about using them maybe to help get Trump elected.
Mm. You mentioned Cohen, the president's attorney, his fixer. Now, we always think of Cohen as, you know, the guy that handles bimbo eruptions for President Trump, the Stormy Daniels case and others. But in your book, Cohen is the key guy for Trump on Russia. Is that right?
He's one of them. You know, Cohen has his own kind of, this is kind of one of the fascinating things I found while reporting. You know, I was poking around, as we've been talking about, the Russian mafia in the 1980s in New York, and calling a bunch of former investigators, and it's one of those moments as a journalist that you're excited about, because the people just seem to be waiting for the phone to ring. And I was talking to one investigator, and this person told me, I wasn't even thinking about Cohen. This person tells me, well, I have information for you about Michael Cohen. And it turns out that Michael Cohen has all kinds of mob associations as well. His uncle ran a catering hall in Brighton Beach, this kind of hub of the Russian mafia that was actually used as the headquarters of the Russian mafia for many years. And Cohen married into a Ukrainian family, and his father-in-law is what my sources told me is has acted as sort of a conduit for money into Trump's properties, that the father-in-law has helped get money from Russia and Ukraine into Trump's businesses. And it was sort of as a thank you or a favor, as a way of showing thanks, that Trump brought Cohen into his organization, or at least that's how the association began.
Now, President Trump has made fun of the press's obsession or investigations into his connections with Russia. He's kind of taunted the press. I mean, your book is a pretty thick and detailed book. It has more names than a Russian novel in it. but I wonder, when you hear the president kind of taunting the press, saying, Russia, 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 kind of laughing about it, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I think it speaks volumes that he is. Look, if there was nothing to hide here, he would welcome an investigation. You know, he would want to be cleared. He would want people, Russian infiltration of his campaign, to be exposed, to get the rot out and clean house. And instead, he's taken the opposite approach of kind of going turtle and pulling his head into the shell and screaming at anybody who investigates as fake news or whatnot. And he's also now attacking, you know, Robert Mueller, which is even more egregious in my view. You know, despite what Trump says, Robert Mueller is, first of all, he's a Republican. This is a man who's committed to the rule of law and order. He's a very honorable man. And, there are lots of things that are shady or questionable, but, you know, whether they're criminal or not, you know, we need somebody to kind of make that decision, and that's, you know, that's where I see Robert Mueller's role going to be in this whole thing. I think in the end, I'm not sure. I think Robert Mueller will disappoint some people, and others will be pleased. I'm not sure which party where that'll fall, but I think he's going to give us a fair ruling and a fair accounting.
One last question. This dossier that that I think now conservatives are complaining about, that they say launched the entire investigation into the Trump administration. And I think Fox News and others are saying, look, this is the dossier is based on faulty information paid for by Democrats. Were you able to confirm any of the details in the dossier?
No, and I kind of stay away from the dossier a little bit. Obviously it has its role in this story, as you said, it sparked this whole Russia collusion story. I was able to actually show that I think in some cases that some of the elements in the dossier may not be true, that, you know, especially the most salacious parts, which I think your listeners are probably familiar with from hearing it many times. You know, what I found is that when in these kinds of investigations by professional security services, that kind of stuff comes up a lot, and a lot of the time it's just nonsense. Unfortunately, you know, that's become the most the biggest focus of the dossier has been the most salacious parts. But, you know, there's stuff in there that the general thrust of the dossier, that Putin, you know, was kind of using the Trump campaign, was trying to influence the Trump campaign and wanted to undermine American democracy, you know, that's been confirmed by our intelligence services. So the general thrust is there, and in these things, what you really saw when you looked at the dossier was raw intelligence, and that's how this game works. It's not all 100% accurate. It's not a legal document. It's intelligence. And, you know, I think a lot of it may be true. Some of it may not. And, you know, we have to rely on our investigators to kind of sort that out for us.
Seth Hetna, thank you so much for coming on WMNF. Is there anything else that you'd like to point out about your new book, Trump Russia, A Definitive History?
Yeah, just, you know, this is, you know, as we've kind of gone over, this is a really confusing story, and there's a lot of twists and turns. We get information kind of out of sequence, and what my book is kind of the first kind of definitive history, and it kind of puts these things into context and shows that what happened during the election is not something new. That there's been these associations that have gone on for a long time, and I you know, I wanted to help people understand that this is a story that has a history to it, and that's kind of what, you know, what my book is about. And I think it helps people, maybe when they go to the voting booth, understand, you know, who they're voting for.
Well, it's good to go back and kind of look at all the years of the relationship between Trump and these Russian business people, if we can call them that, or Russian mafias, some people call them. Seth Hetna, thank you so much for coming on WMNF.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Well, that's former Associated Press reporter Seth Hetna. I kept mispronouncing his name during that interview. His book is called Trump, Russia, A Definitive History, and he traces Trump's connections to shady Russian business people back to the 1980s. So if we're going to open up the phone lines right now and take your phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. You can email your comments into the studio at dj@wmnf.org. Adam Baxt is our phone producer today. And Mike writes this regarding the interview that we just heard. He said, the more Russia, the better. He says, it makes me want to open a Russian fast food truck. If you haven't seen the amazing series, The Americans, it's the best TV show in 20 years, writes Mike. Okay, I have not seen The Americans. I understand it's about a covert group of Russians, Russian moles living in the U.S. Well, yesterday I had Graham Brink on, who's the new business columnist for the Tampa Bay Times, and two stories I just want to refer you to. He looked at CEO pay versus the median employee's pay here in the Tampa Bay area. And there's a chart on page 4B, or I'm sorry, 4A of the Tampa Bay Times. And Graham writes that of the local companies, locally owned companies, the CEO who has the highest pay compared to his typical worker is Charles Sykes of Sykes Enterprises. Sykes got $4.2 million in compensation, and the average worker, the typical worker, made $10,450 last year. So that's a 406-to-1 ratio for the head of Sykes Enterprises. And then the national companies that operate here, it looks like McDonald's has the worst ratio. The CEO, Steve Easterbrook, took in $21.8 million last year. And that compares to the average worker at McDonald's, who takes in $7,017 a year. The average worker at McDonald's, the typical worker at McDonald's. Pretty interesting. The ratio there is Easterbrook makes 3,101 times more than the average worker does. And you've seen all those McDonald's workers on, or those McDonald's ads on TV talking about what a great job it is. Take that for what it's worth, $7,000 a year for the typical McDonald's worker. Our phone number, 813-239-9663, email address dj@wmnf.org. And I think in the coming days, Graham's going to have a story in the paper, and I'll just read the first few lines. Many Americans still cannot afford a $400 setback. And he writes, could you pay an unexpected $400 expense? More than 4 in 10 Americans say they could not without borrowing money or selling something, according to the Federal Reserve's report on the economic well-being of U.S. households released yesterday. So the average, about 40% of Americans could not afford a $400 setback. Let's take some phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Let's go to John in Palmetto. Hi, John. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind today?
How you doing, Rob?
I'm good.
Well,
what's up?
I was fighting to get through yesterday to talk on this exact subject. And basically, this came out in about 84. NBC did a short piece on it, and on
you're Trump, talking about Trump and Russia.
Yeah, on okay. Trump and Russia.
Right.
Trump and Russia, and also in money laundering later in 2001, 2012, and 2014. In 2014, he went and where he really started raking it in was in Panama. Trump had the Trump Ocean Club. And what it was he was asked to use, he tried to sell his name, is what he usually does, like in Tampa. It was similar to the deal he did in Tampa. Well, he was going to get several million dollars for that, but really his daughter and Trump Jr. and he sort of took it over after a year. And now this is, it hadn't even stuck a shovel in dirt yet. And 3/4 of the units were sold. But of the 420, 430 of units that consist of the building, 49% of them were bought up by Russian oligarchs and Russian mob.
Mm, there you go.
And Trump raked in $79.4 million. And instead of just the name, they for almost a year, he and his daughter and son pretty much ran the operations there. So it's really not known to what extent that, you know, and this is part of what is supposed to be a real reason he doesn't want his income taxes, because for one thing, he's not required to show the kind of money the money exchange is down there, but whatever he himself pretty much laundered back to the U.S. is you know, can be contradicted with what happened there in Panama. So he is what's called a passive mob king. You know, he in his own right, because really back to you know, Al Capone, they all had their hands in a lot of the banks, but also in the holes in the backs of the representatives too.
Yeah, you know, I thought in that interview with Seth Hetena that his line where he said that sometime in the 1990s, I believe it was, that Trump went from mysteriously being the king of debt to being the king of cash. Something happened there where he turned his whole empire around. Well, he was borrowing so much less, and the infusion of cash from the Russians may be the best explanation.
Yeah, this came in on the feed of him. He had five consecutive bankruptcies he filed.
Yeah, he did
over a few years, and he's been on a roll ever since. You know, and part of what some think that he really exaggerated his wealth and stuff is to sort of help throw people off and the authorities off because one thing Mueller's doing is he's got to be. This is my assumption. He's got to be running into far more cash, because what happened was in there, not just the Russian mob, but also money launderers and in Colombia were coming up and buying things, and they were shipping it into Panama in metal crates.
Wow. Well, let's hope Mueller gets to the bottom of all this. John, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you.
All right, great to hear from you. Let's go to Mike in Bradenton. Hey, Mike, you're on WMNF. What's on your mind?
Hey, Rob, I really appreciate your show. I just wanted to say, you know, James Clapper, his new book is out, the longtime intelligence community. I think he was the national security director for 4 years.
Yeah, no, I didn't watch his interview last night on Rachel Maddow. Is that what you're going to refer to?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, I mean,
what did he say last night? Because I didn't watch it.
Well, I didn't see the interview, but she pulled out his book and said, here's an interesting portion. He says, basically, yeah, we can now say, you know, I can say as a private citizen that the Russians definitely swung the election to Trump. And he breaks down, you know, the number of Twitter bots they've got and the, you know, that Facebook noted that 126 million Americans had received one of those. At least one of those fake memes that they were sending around. And, you know, only 139 million Americans voted. So that's like, you know, I don't know the math, but it's, you know, it's like 85% people that voted.
If that was true in 2016, can you imagine what's going to happen in 2020 or even 2018?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's my fear. I guess the current national security director was asked yesterday, you know, if she what she thought about that, and she said she wasn't aware of it. So,
you know, and she's from here in the Tampa Bay area. Her dad lives here. It's strange that she's so out of touch, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it's rather peculiar, and I'm trying to figure out what happened, because the Republicans used to be the law and order party, and they're awfully quiet these days about some of these things. And, you know, we really have to get everybody out there voting. I mean, we have to get all groups have just got to come together. And the only way to beat this, I think, is by outvoting them with all the shenanigans that's going to happen.
All right, Mike, thanks a lot. Mike, thank you. Let's go to Bill in Port Charlotte. Hey, Bill, we only have 30 seconds. What would you like to say?
I just was going to ask you a question on how I could find out who voted against that, the the bill that they passed yesterday in the Senate to repeal
the partial repeal of the Dodd-Frank bill.
Yeah, how can I find out who voted?
It's all over the place. I'll tell you what, Bill, call me after the show, and I'll tell you how to find it, okay?
Okay, good.
All right. You can call the main number, 813-238-8001. And that's also the number where you can leave a comment about today's show. If you want to comment about today's show, call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115, and I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Now stay tuned for NOLA and the Midpoint Program. This is WMNF Tampa St. Pete.